from Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world. This is FSN Reports. I'm Simon Marks. Today, a special edition of the program that looks at the crisis in global education and one man's proposals for fixing it. Salman Khan is one of the most prominent and controversial voices in the debate over how to improve grades here in the US and overseas.
I think the state will always play a very strong role. I think public education is a very, very powerful thing. Our role is to show where, without extra money, with the resources on hand, you're able to move the dial.
His Khan Academy on YouTube has already taught millions, but now he's calling for the creation of a one-world schoolhouse. And you'll hear about his ideas and the people who disagree with him, coming up on FSN Reports. But first, our summary of the day's main news.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. An earthquake with a high magnitude of at least 7.3 on the Richter scale has hit the Fukushima region of Japan. Tremors were felt at least 300 miles away, and damage is still being assessed. From San Francisco, Rebecca Bowring has an update.
The quake struck 231 miles east of the Japanese island of Honshu. There have been no immediate reports of damage on land, but Japan's meteorological agency issued a yellow tsunami warning. A wave no greater than 1 meter in height is expected to hit the coast at Fukushima. It's far smaller than the one that deluged the region in March 2011, following the devastating magnitude 9 earthquake. Fukushima is home to a stricken nuclear reactor which is still being repaired. The Pacific Tsunami Warning Center says any tsunami is unlikely to be catastrophic, but there could be damage along coasts within 100 miles of the quake epicenter. Rebecca Bowring, San Francisco.
American officials have been in contact with several foreign intelligence agencies to alert them that former NSA contractor Edward Snowden has details of their secret cooperation with the U.S. The officials say Snowden possesses tens of thousands of military intelligence documents, some of which contain sensitive materials about collection programs against common adversaries such as Iran, Russia, and China. The data may also reveal operations with countries not known to be allied to the U.S. Here's Washington correspondent Lorna Shattuck.
U.S. officials from the Office of the Director of National Intelligence are reportedly having to get in contact with capital after capital, letting governments know there's a risk that Edward Snowden could reveal details of their cooperation with American intelligence services. They've told the Washington Post newspaper that there's another complicating factor. In some cases, one part of the government they're contacting may know about the collaboration, while another department might not even be aware of it. They say that if much of the information is disclosed, it could compromise ongoing operations. Lorna Shattuck, Washington.
And continuing Snowden revelations also have implication on America's known allies. European leaders gathering in Brussels for two-day talks have demanded a trust pact with the U.S. over allegations of extensive spying on EU governments. German Chancellor Angela Merkel and French President François Hollande are now calling for bilateral meetings with Washington after suggesting relations have been bruised. Sandra Gatman reports from Brussels.
European leaders released a joint statement on Friday condemning extensive U.S. surveillance as alleged by documents leaked by fugitive U.S. intelligence worker Edward Snowden. It said France and Germany will seek bilateral talks with the U.S. before the end of the year, but the initiative may also end up including other countries. The European Union is sending a delegation to Washington on Monday to seek a response to allegations of widespread spying by the NSA against EU citizens and governments. Sandra Gatman, Brussels.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. A new report finds that Iran could produce one bomb's worth of weapons-grade uranium in a month's time. The researchers argue Tehran's likely capability should inform the talks underway about their nuclear program. Washington correspondent Priscilla Huff has more.
Iran could have enough weapons-grade uranium for a bomb in 1 month's time. The new report from the Institute for Science and International Security evaluated the likely scenarios for refining Iran's known stockpile of low-grade uranium to weapons-grade. Their research is based on the known configuration of Iran's centrifuges, the devices used to refine uranium. ISIS feels that because Iran could have weapons-grade uranium in just a few weeks' time, This point has clear implications for any negotiations with Tehran. They feel the priority for talks is slowing the process, especially since the big unknown is how far along Iran is towards the rest of the atomic bomb technology. Priscilla Huff, Washington.
And the lower house of the Russian parliament has passed a new legislation strengthening punishment for terrorists and terrorism-related activity. Training and membership in terrorist groups fall under the new law. The measure is aimed to counter future terrorist attacks, particularly in the region of Sochi in southern Russia, where the 2014 Winter Olympics will take place. Daria Bondarchuk reports from Moscow.
The State Duma deputies voted unanimously for toughening punishment for involvement in or training for terrorist activities. Those found guilty of the crime may face up to 10 years in prison, while terrorists fighting in militant groups abroad may face a 6-year jail term. The new law also stipulates that the relatives of a terrorist may be obliged to pay for the damages caused in attacks. The measure comes as yet another step of the Kremlin to counter possible terrorist attacks in the Northern Caucasus, a region neighboring the city of Sochi, where the 2014 Winter Olympic Games will be held next February. Daria Bondarchuk, Moscow.
And that's the latest feature story news. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Simon Marks. Welcome to FSN Reports. Today, a special edition of the program in which you'll hear some pugnacious and controversial thoughts about the future of children's education. They come from Salman Khan, author of a book called The One World Schoolhouse and founder of the online Khan Academy. 37 years old, he's a Bangladeshi American who quit his day job as a hedge fund manager and became a YouTube sensation.
You know, literally in 2004, I had just gotten married, and I had some family visiting me after the wedding in Boston. And in particular, I had my 12-year-old cousin Nadia visiting, and incredibly bright. I was really impressed with her. It was actually the first time that I had interacted with her as an adult. And while we were meeting, I actually told her mom, I was like, you know, Nadia's showing a lot of potential. I think she could really do some amazing things. And her mom said, well, that's really nice, and they view you as it's kind of an older brother figure, but Nadia's actually having trouble with math. So I offered to tutor her remotely. So she was based in New Orleans, which is where I grew up. And so she agreed that when she would go back, every day after work for me and after school for her, we would do a remote tutoring session. And so we started doing that. Long story short, in about 2 months, she had kind of gotten over that hurdle and actually gotten ahead of her grade level. And everything was working out. Then I started tutoring her younger brothers remotely. And then about 18 months later, word had gotten around to the family that some free tutoring was going on. So I was tutoring on the order of 10 or so cousins and family members every day after work. And I actually already started writing a little piece of software to give them practice problems. And so I, as their tutor, could keep track of what they were doing. And a friend said, oh, this is really cool software, but, you know, I was telling him how I was having trouble scaling myself with the actual live tutorials. And he suggested, well, why don't you make some videos and put them up on YouTube? And I thought that was a silly idea. I said, you know, YouTube's for cats playing piano, not for serious mathematics. But I got over the idea it wasn't mine, and I gave it a shot. And that was 2006. November 2006 was the first video I uploaded. And I now famously, my cousin's first point of feedback was that they liked me better on YouTube than in person. And I kept going. And before long, it became obvious that people who were not my cousins were watching the videos, and they started to send letters, and my wife will tell you I'm a sucker for positive feedback, so I kept going, and by 2009, had set it up as a not-for-profit, and I just had trouble focusing on my day job, and so sat down with my wife, and we figured that we had enough savings for about a year to try to start this not-for-profit thing called the Khan Academy, or it had already started, but to commit myself to it full time.
But that's an incredibly bold leap, isn't it? A hedge fund manager throwing it all up and saying, I'm actually going to put my future on YouTube.
I think it started off from a place where I never viewed this as a business. And frankly, I still don't view this as a business because it's not a business. I just viewed it as a really fun hobby. I had this day job working as an analyst at a hedge fund. I was doing just fine. And then I got to come home and get these nice thank you letters and go into some math and science that I liked talking about or researching or teaching. And it really just, that started to overtake my life. So I had to just introspect what was really making me happy. And I kind of determined that if I could do whatever this Khan Academy thing was becoming, if I could do that full time and get a professor salary, that would be worth more to me than becoming a big hedge fund manager.
You said that at the time, YouTube was really known for being the website of teenagers dancing in their bedrooms and skateboarding cats. You actually played a role in changing the reputation of the YouTube brand.
I wasn't the first person to ever put educational videos on YouTube. I think what's unique about Khan Academy, or at least those first videos that I had done, is that they had gotten broad traction. And I don't think people had seen something like that before. And I think that helped the public perception of YouTube to be perceived as not just a place for silly, fun videos, but also a place where you could learn something.
And then this thing rapidly scaled.
Yeah, it's like you learn about exponential growth in school, and when you're growing from 10 to 13 people in a month, it doesn't seem that crazy that you grew 30% in a month. But when you grow from 100,000 to 130,000 people in a month, or 1 million to 1.3 million people in a month, then you start to realize what exponential growth is.
And so where are you now in terms of the number of videos you've produced, the number of people watching, the number of countries that are utilizing the Khan Academy's materials?
So right now, it's well over 3,000 videos. They've been watched over 180 million times. The breakdown has been 60% North America, 40% rest of the world. It's as far as we can tell, every country that has internet access that hasn't blocked us, and a few have. I think blocked us as part of YouTube. I don't think they have anything against us.
Those controversial math classes.
Those controversial math classes and science classes. And in terms of what we are, and this is one thing I want to emphasize, is that we definitely, the videos were what got the most notoriety and definitely are still a big part of what we are, but most of the resources we're now spending on Khan Academy are around the interactive portions of it in terms of the problem sets that students can do. They get feedback. There's dashboards for parents and teachers and students. And we just launched a computer science portion of our site, which is a very interactive way to learn computer science.
So I want to ask you about that, because the point came where you realized that this was about more than simply putting instructional videos up on the internet for people to use.
I've always had ambitions from when I was in college all the way through my career. I was like, I think software could do something to help people learn. And I wasn't the first person to think that. There have been many attempts to create software to help people learn. And so I viewed my cousins as almost guinea pigs. I could see if they could learn through software. And then the videos were just a supplement to that. So the idea of using interactive software is kind of predates the videos. But then once we got a lot of notoriety and there were people who came out of the woodwork and said, oh, we'd like to fund you. What do you think Khan Academy could be? That's where I said, look, I think the videos are great and we can translate them into many, many languages, and we are right now. But I don't think that's a complete offering. I think we need to supplement that, or they should be the supplement to interactive problem sets. We should have explorations. We should have data. We should have tools for teachers so they could use this, ways that this could complement a physical classroom. And so that's what most of our resources are being spent on.
So when you think about the educational establishment, I mean, schools, institutions of learning, universities, they have large staffs that produce coursework and deal with students on a continuing basis. What have you got?
We're 35 people right now. On the content side, I still produce videos, and I do other things here in the organization. We have two art historians making art history videos, and then we have two other, I would call them closer to being real film producers. They do more edited, more highly produced videos. I'm still making math and science videos. And then the rest of our team is mainly software engineers, teachers, education researchers who are helping interface with the outside world, seeing what we can learn from best practices that are happening out there and research and bringing it into the product.
So when you produce a video, for example, on molecular chemistry, I mean, I understand that Sal Khan knows how to do basic math, but what do you know about molecular chemistry? How are you in a position to create that video and put it up there?
Yes, so that's the fun thing, and the challenging thing for me individually is, yes, there's some things that by virtue of my background I know reasonably well. There's other things I've always wanted to know better. This is motivation for me to get better at it. So for example, if I'm doing biochemistry, you know, I know it reasonably well, but in order to teach it, you have to learn it at a much deeper level. I will immerse myself in that subject. And then once I feel like it's really distilled in my brain and I understand it as intuitively as I understand math or physics or anything else like that, I'll make the video. And the really powerful thing is that we have kind of the whole world being our editorial. Once I put up a video, We have, within a day, we'll have several thousand people view it. And some are students looking to learn it, but many of them are teachers, professors, graduate students looking to maybe use it or even critique it. Sometimes they're not always friends of ours, but they'll critique it, and we'll take those very seriously, and we'll say, oh, is that a legitimate critique? Oh, it is. Maybe we should make another video clarifying something. Maybe we should redo the video. So we do that quite often. We're always looking at what people are saying.
I want to talk more about the critique in a second, but first of all, explain a little bit more about your philosophy of education, because as you've developed this system, you have thought arguably as deeply as anybody else in this country about educational philosophy, and you don't see successful education as in a classic top-down professor behind a desk giving a lecture to a group of students who are all sitting in a classroom listening and soaking it in and then learn to regurgitate it by rote.
That's exactly right. I don't think that the traditional lecture model is the ideal use of either a professor or teacher's time. I actually think real learning always takes place when the student decides to learn. And what I believe strongly is people should be able to learn at their own pace. They should be able to get a solid grounding in basic subjects before they're forced to move on. Right now, what you're happening is, we see happening especially in math and science, but I think across other subjects, is people have a weak understanding of exponents. They're given a grade, maybe a B or a C, and then they're moved on to the next topic, which builds on that. It might be logarithms or negative exponents. And somehow the current system expects that student to now be able to understand something more complicated, even though the assessment already showed they didn't understand the more basic thing. So what we say is, instead of holding fixed when you have to learn something and how long you have to learn something, and the variable is how well you learn it, and that's usually a grade, we say, let's go the other way around. Let's let someone learn at their own pace. The variable is how long they have to learn something and when they learn it, and what's fixed is that they have a high level of mastery. And if they have a high level of mastery, they have all their gaps filled, then when they go to the next topic, the more advanced topic, it'll seem almost intuitive. And in terms of the virtual and physical, we think that when people are in a physical environment together, they should be interacting with each other. They should be teaching each other, talking to each other, building things, working on projects. And so right now you have lecture halls where it's a passive environment. Students are listening, taking notes. A teacher is giving a lecture that they might have given many times before. We think a lot of that stuff can happen at a student's own pace. And when they go to the lecture hall, or it won't be a lecture hall anymore, they can do peer-to-peer interaction, they can tutor each other, they can tackle hard problems together, and they'll have the teacher there to actually interact with them, to answer their questions and mentor them.
You said there it won't be a lecture hall anymore. I mean, that is a radical rethinking of the way the educational establishment works.
Yeah, you know, it's both radical and not so radical. You know, throughout, I mean, the last 100 years, there have been examples of this. If you go to some of the top business schools in the world, they have a case method, which is essentially that students do their reading and preparation at their own time, and when they come together, they do not have a lecture, they have a conversation. And in a lot of the humanities classes, this has been standard practice, where students do some reading, they do some research at their own time, and when they come together, they don't get a lecture, they have a conversation, they have a seminar. And so there's no reason why this can't be naturally extended to everything. Because the information delivery that traditionally happens in lecture, we now think can happen in better ways outside of the lecture hall. And now the lecture, or what used to be the lecture hall, this physical experience, can now move up the value chain. But to what you're saying, I guess it could also be viewed as radical, because right now a disproportionate amount of class time is that traditional lecture.
Well, there are clearly some people out there who view this as threatening. I'm sure you're familiar with a blog post that appeared on the Chronicle of Higher Education website, which said, Khan Academy is great for learning about lots of different subjects. That's nice. But it's not really adequate for learning those subjects on a level that makes a difference in the world. Not so nice.
Yeah, well, you know, that second part is a tough question, I think, for education generally. You know, when we're put Khan Academy aside, when kids are in physics class or calculus class, how many of them are translating that to their everyday life, or, you know, or they're in biology class or whatever? And I think this is a question that Khan Academy and everyone across the education spectrum has to ask themselves. Are these translatable skills? Are these skills that are meaningful for students? With that said, we don't think we're by any means perfect, and we're at just the very early stages of what we're doing. But I think, you know, the students and teachers that are using them, they are definitely getting value out of it. I mean, you know, this is the 5 million students and the 10,000 teachers who are using it. No one's telling them to. No one's forcing them to. And so we kind of look to them and say, where are you finding value in the Khan Academy, and where can we improve? But, you know, to that point, we don't think it's a solved problem. But I think what we're going to try to do over the next year, 5 years, 10 years, hopefully 100 years, is just keep improving, keep iterating, so we can strive after that goal.
So there's another criticism out there that says simply doing a lecture on video isn't all that innovative. I presume you would say, well, we're not simply doing a lecture on video.
First, I would agree with that statement. Simply doing a lecture on video is not that innovative. So just on the video side, what's new here is that here's a collection that has gotten traction, that students and teachers and parents are finding valuable at a scale, and by no means is it perfect. There's a lot of work we can do. But then the second part I would say is I agree as well that video alone isn't the whole thing, and that's why most of our resources are on the interactive side, having students do problems, having them do explorations. And then on top of that, we're even exploring physical programs like summer schools, and we're working with physical schools themselves so that we can say, look, how do we create a holistic experience for these students?
Well, that goes to another criticism. Some critics have said rather than revolutionizing mathematics teaching and learning, the Khan Academy's work adds a technological patina to a moribund notion of teaching and learning mathematics. In other words, they're essentially accusing you of standing up a broken system rather than dismantling it and changing it.
I actually think some of this criticism comes from misunderstanding what we are trying to do. If you see these video lectures and if you see these online exercises, you might think, oh, these people think that's education. No, we think that's a tool for education. That's a tool for enabling the physical experience to become more project-based, to do real hands-on things. And I think once you do that, I think actually a lot of these critics are the ones that believe strongly in hands-on learning, who believe in explorative learning, who believe that students should struggle with real hard problems and have their professors there to mentor them as opposed to lecture them. So I think we're on the same page, and sometimes we're just misperceived a little bit.
Now, you're a young organization. Does that mean that at some point soon you will have metrics that prove the success or failure of the system?
We've been talking with actually hundreds of teachers in schools about how they can use it. And we've been doing studies. And so we've been partnering with organizations to measure pre-test, post-test, how are these students doing. There's actually a tremendous blog post from what happened in Oakland Unity. The students improved fairly dramatically. And ours is, these tests we don't view as a thumbs up or thumbs down. We view it as, where does this work and where does this not work? Or what are the practices where this tool is being used in a positive way and it's definitely moving the dial? What are the practices where maybe it's not happening as much? And how can we get those practices to look more like the ones that are working? So for us, it's much more of, we care a lot about the data and we are seeing pretty good improvement. But for us, it's not a thumbs up or thumbs down. It's how do we iterate? How do we improve? How do we share best practices? Even the ones where we are seeing results, how do we improve those results even more? How do we get the students more engaged? How do we get them further up their learning curve?
Are there any parents out there that worry about their kids being guinea pigs?
There's been a lot of transparency with parents. But if anything, we've gone the other way. It's that there's actually been demand from parents who aren't part of the program. They've been kind of clamoring more for it than the other way around.
If you look at the statistics concerning education in the United States, it is apparent action has to be taken. American students rank 25th in math and 21st in science compared to the students in 30 industrialized countries. More than 1.2 million students drop out of school every year. Looking broadly at the educational panorama here, how critical is change needed?
Well, it's huge. I mean, education is the core of everything. And I'll even, you know, and obviously the U.S. has issues being pretty far down the list, especially of wealthy countries in terms of how students are performing. But I actually think it's a global thing. I think even in the top performing countries, they have far too many students who are struggling with math, struggling with science. I mean, in the U.S., it's at the level where at a lot of four-year universities, a majority of students are having to take essentially pre-algebra or having to take middle school math, which shows that they didn't actually get a lot out of what they were exposed to later on in their careers. So, but I think it's universal. I mean, I think you go even some of the top-performing countries, whether it's Korea or Finland or whatever, and you'll see tons of students falling through the cracks. And so we hope to help all of these students globally not fall.
But can the United States turn around what is becoming, in educational terms, a real competitive disadvantage when it looks particularly toward Asia and it sees developments in China and the rising of India and other nations in other parts of the world? Is this something that can, at this point, be turned around?
I don't know. I don't know what kind of the, you know, there's a system out there. And the one thing we're careful is we don't want to be, I don't want to be viewed as like an ed reformer who's going there with a stick and trying to somehow reform the system. I don't know if that's possible. I don't know how it can be done. Obviously, it becomes very political, and other people better equipped are trying to fight that fight in ways that they see fit. Our goal is to, let's see what we can do with these tools. Let's make the case that these tools are very accessible and anyone can do them as long as there's a will to use them. And then hopefully the change will happen from the ground up. And frankly, that is what we are at least starting to see. You know, one thing that I and our team is very careful, we've had ministers of education come to us and governors and say, oh, I want to mandate this in our state. And I was like, no, don't mandate anything. Because as soon as you mandate it, it can be broken. And it can be implemented badly. Any tool, a piece of chalk, can be used well or it can be used badly. And at this stage, we did not want this type of thing. Actually, at any stage, what we want is the other way. We want it to be pulled. We want students and parents and individual teachers, the ones that are actively kind of on the ground, to say, you know, this is a pretty valuable tool. And I, you know, most all, or if not all teachers, all students, all parents want the student to learn. And so if they see something happening, if their neighbor is doing something and that student is, you know, getting ahead, or if it helped them out with their grades, that word of mouth, I think, is the strongest way to change things. And that's what we've been kind of, you know, our growth of the 5 million users, it's not a government telling someone you have to use Khan Academy. It's not, it's people telling each other, hey, this worked for my neighbor, or this worked for my son, you might want to try it.
Right, but if a private initiative, ultimately, I know it's run as a non-for-profit, but ultimately this is a private initiative.
Non-governmental,
Can engage in that kind of activity. Is there a point at which there's a debate to be had about the role someone like you plays in educating children versus the role traditionally played by the state?
That's something I have no real opinion about. I mean, I have an opinion of, but to put simply, I think the state will always play a very strong role. I think public education is a very, very powerful thing. I think our role is to show cases where without extra money, with the resources on hand, you're able to move the dial. And if we can show that, and we can show it across use cases, whether it's affluent neighborhoods, underserved neighborhoods, different demographics, different geographies, then I think we will have done our part. And then other people say, well, it's just a matter of do you adopt it or do you not? And especially if we lower all of the barriers to adoption. But I don't think, it's already getting a little political, us giving away free videos, educational videos. I definitely don't think it's even our place to go and say, this is the way public school should be, or this is how it should be funded, or anything like that.
And you view all this in a transnational fashion. I mean, you've spoken about creating the global One World Classroom. Your book is going to be called The One World Schoolhouse. This isn't just about lifting educational standards in one country.
Yeah, well, absolutely. I mean, you know, right now our content is primarily in English, but it's already being used around the world. We're doing translations into Spanish, Portuguese, Mandarin, Hindi, Bengali, the top 10 languages of the world, and then we're going to go from there. Our goal over the next year is to localize the site so it's available in all of the world's languages. We've talked to people about how can we introduce more content on the site that could be regional specific, maybe if you want to learn a specific skill in a particular part of the world. So we really want to view this as like an institution for the world so that hopefully in 50 years, access to a world-class education will be like clean drinking water. It'll be, you know, it's not why, it'll be why not. And it'll be ridiculously inexpensive to deliver it to someone in a village that right now has no access to anything. So that is the goal. And I actually think it'll help everybody if we can get there.
Can he get there? Can Salman Khan genuinely create the global One World Classroom of his dreams? With Silicon Valley's track record of success and the wind of the information superhighway at his back, he at least thinks he's in with a chance. That's our special Friday edition of FSN Reports. On Monday, we'll be back with our more usual diet of reports from our correspondents around the world. I'm Simon Marks. For everyone with FSN everywhere, have a great weekend. Goodbye.